Uncommon is a production by Neural, a full-service digital agency. If you want to grow with a premium agency and have the ability to work with Jordan directly, then learn more at neural.com/media and request a callback. That's neurale.com/media.
My name's Jordan Michaelides, and I'm the host of Uncommon, a show that asks the why on business, media, current affairs, and sport. Uncommon Corona Edition sees us catching up with prior guests to document how they're adapting during this once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. If you like the episode, do leave a written review on your podcast app, as it does help us continue what we're doing. Don't forget that there's plenty of past episodes to keep you entertained at home. Show notes are below. You can also find all previous guests at neurale.com/uncommon. That's neurale.com/uncommon. For the full video, just search Uncommon Show on YouTube. And for social, to keep up to date with behind the scenes, search at uncommon_show. With that being said, let's get into the episode. My guest this week is Nick Hodges, strategic advisor to startups, investors, and media companies, founder of Blonde3 and board member of Startup Victoria. Nick, we were just chatting before. I know you've moved. How did that go mid coronavirus?
Surprisingly not challenging. It was sort of nice to have a change of scenery, and then we've been in the new place 3 weeks, and we immediately did a bunch of sort of remodeling. So I may be incriminating myself here, but today's the first weekday that we haven't had tradespeople in the house doing stuff, which is fine. It's allowed. They're allowed to come in.
Yeah, that's essential. Every job is essential.
Every job is essential. So it's been an interesting experience for us.
Which side of the Yarra were you living on prior?
Oh, south, always south.
Always south, okay. So you've always been on the right side of the Yarra.
No, when I was at university, and you're meant to live on the north.
Yeah, I said this to Lauren the other day. I feel like I said it to you when we caught up for coffee a month or so ago. Maybe it was 2 months ago.
My last work coffee with a person.
Really?
Yep.
So it must have been Feb. I think it was Feb. I haven't looked back at my calendar. I'm over living this close to the city/the Yarra. I need to get back over to the southeastern suburbs, get back to my roots. We've actually been looking at like where would we move to, because my parents are still in Brighton, but Lauren's parents have moved to, do you know Martha Cove?
No. Sounds flash though.
It's sort of like a glorified old people's home, like a retirement village, but it's like a development down at Safety Beach. So we're sort of considering, as we get married over the next year and consider things like kids, where do we start living? Being closer to parents would be nice.
But so not anyway, too close.
Not too close. Not too close at all. Now, speaking of kids, you gave me some amazing notes for questions to ask people over this coronavirus series. And one of the first ones that stood out to me was...
I wish I could remember them all now.
Well, one of the ones was around scarification. I feel like that's got some of the best moments. We had Dan Monheit, who doesn't see it like World War II. And then we've got the week after Shura Taft, who sees it like World War II. So I guess for you, from your perspective, what's... how do you see this moment?
I was about to say good question, but apparently I fed you the question, so I won't say that. Look, it's something that I've really, since the start of, or since it became clear that this was going to become global, it's been an interesting thing to think about. I think probably a starting point for thinking about the idea of scarification, the idea of long-term impact on or long-term sort of generational impact, is probably that it's hard to see a revolution when you're living in it. And I think probably when we're thinking about the long-term sort of social impacts of this, you know, reasonably sort of 6 to 12 months, it's probably hard to understand the scale of it until we're out of it. So I think this is as sitting on the fence as you can get, but it could be that it creates long-term behavioural changes within society and within people based on their life stage right now that will flow through. Sort of like, you know, grandparents of, you know, my generation's grandparents, you know, they always talked about rationing and, you know, they always, you know, used the last little bit of jam and stuff. And so, you know, that's a really extreme thing. But I think I'm very cautious of A, using war terminology, and B, putting this experience in parallel to going through, you know, half a decade of war and the longer term impacts of that. Mm. So maybe it's that. But my other thought is maybe it's not. Maybe it's a blip, and that perhaps, you know, children that are being born today are going to be, you know, constantly sort of getting up us about, you know, talking about the time that we all had to go into isolation. It's like, it really doesn't sound that bad, does it? Oh. So, yeah, look, I think it'll be interesting. You know, I think at the start, I just had a few conversations with people who were like, yeah, you know, a lot of my friends obviously love to pile on boomers. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion around, you know, sort of I guess the response to this crisis from some older generations who naturally sort of sway more conservatively was, oh, this isn't a problem. You know, you kids today, you haven't lived through hardships. And, you know, a lot of my friends were like, well, like neither of you, like the boomer generation is the least scarified generation in the history of civilization, really. Like, they lived through a post-war boom. Like the Vietnam War is probably, you know, Korea War, Vietnam War is sort of the biggest thing that they could hold up as sort of causing, you know, any long-term behavioral change, but arguably it didn't really at all. And so, you know, they haven't really lived through much. And so to sort of turn around and be like, you know, you kids today, you wouldn't know how hard it is. Like, actually, this is probably the most significant thing that's happened in their lives too, in terms of this sort of situation.
That meme for them changed a bit though. I did notice that in our parents' generation, but it went quickly from this is nothing to, like, particularly like maybe late March, early April.
Yeah.
April is when people really started to go, oh, okay, fuck, this is serious. Yeah.
Let's call it the Tom Hanks moment, shall we? I mean, look, my thing about that is I'm sort of being cautious. I think it could be maybe not damaging, but I think everyone could get very sort of self-absorbed. And we're seeing this already in sort of corporate hot takes about, oh, how is this going to change the future of work and things like that.
I hate that shit.
Yeah, we could get really self-absorbed really quickly about how this has changed us. And, you know, it's basically going to be, you know, television's going to be unwatchable sort of in 12 months because of all the, you know, documentaries and current affairs and 60 minutes about, oh, how has this changed us? When it's a thing to go through, is it sort of a scarifying moment? You know,
who knows? Probably not. Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the potential long-term implications. I remember before I interviewed Dan, he was on a podcast. It's Russell Howcroft's and Alex, what's his name? Can't remember the bloke's name. I'm meant to be interviewing him soon. That's so bad. but they created a book called Right Brain. And then they've got the Right Brain Movement, and then there's the Right Brain Workout, which is their new podcast. And so they were talking about how workplaces, like in a sense, commercial office spaces will change. And they're trying to debate what will be the things that slingshot back. And I was thinking, you know, what will be the things that slingshot back for us versus stay the same? Like, as an example, about a month ago, when it came to leads in the agency, there was nothing. But now people have realized, okay, well, we have to do something. We have to market to our audience. But they are there. The mood of the consumer or the client has completely changed. They are no longer, we'd never really been the type to offer retainers or lock-in contracts unless for specific services or if the client asks for it. And now that has actually become quite a competitive advantage for us. Like, we found that we've been in deals amongst three different agencies and they've just gone with us, even though the pricing is relatively the same, because we're not locking them in for that 6 month period and they've got flexibility. And I can sort of see how that would be a thing that will not change in the industry because the consumer wants it. There's also the fact that so many of the sales meetings now are done via Zoom. And I wonder how many meetings in person will, you know, like how many people are going to be like, well, don't worry about coming up to Sydney, just present over Zoom. Do you know what I mean?
So I think there's two things there. One being that point around, like, it's never been more okay to be unsure in your job. It's never been more okay to say, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. And a lot of my work now revolves around that, revolves around scenario planning and helping to think about a future that is more unknown than it's ever been. So what we are seeing and what I'm seeing as well is customers of my clients who are like, we don't know what's going to happen in 6 months, but we need this thing now. So yeah, you know, yeah, great. Yeah. If it's a project based contract or it's just a piecemeal thing, customers are fine with that. Now, I think there's a good counter argument, which is that people will desire confidence a lot coming out of this. And when we say coming out of this, it's important to sort of note that this is going to take a while. You know, it's not a war. There's not a day that it's over. It's this slow sort of drawn out process. But, you know, as people start going back into their offices, which I think they will, as people, you know, start sort of returning to the normality of work, which I think people are maybe craving, or, you know, people, I think to a degree, want to get back into the rut of work. And I think that maybe that assurance, that idea that the future is known, could actually be quite desirable. So to counter the idea that the short-term sort of getting in and doing project-based work is going to be a long-term trend, I think there's a counter-argument that may be just as strong, which is people are going to want to feel sure and confident about the decisions they're making and want to feel like they're living in a world that's not about to suddenly turn upside down again.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So it's sort of like the mood of the moment, or horses for courses right now, is short-termism is what helps you survive. Mm. Whereas in 12 to 18 months from now, going back to thinking long-term is what will help survive for a business, just by the matter of where things are.
Yeah. Or it's, you know, it's just the natural, it's just the desire that people have. They're going to want that, whether it's a smart thing to do, whether it's strategically correct is a different story. Mm. But I think it's what they're going to desire is going to be that.
There was something there around the economy, and I know you sent me a really good document from McKinsey, which is sort of, I really like, what's his name? Martin North, who we've interviewed for a client's podcast. He runs a business called Digital Finance Analytics, and they do a lot of heavy lifting when it comes to consulting for financial businesses. I'm pretty sure he actually used to be one of the founding MDs at McKinsey when they came out here back in the 70s or 80s. He's originally from the UK, really, really smart guy. And so I've had a read through your document, and I was watching his live stream last night, which is always interesting to watch. The economy is what is on everyone's lips right now that they feel some sense of comfort that the numbers have come down, and I can sort of see people starting to relax, and that's another topic in and of itself around case numbers. But the topic at the moment is what does the economy look like for the next 6, 12 and 18 months? I mean, it's obvious unemployment is massive. I think on Martin's piece last night, the job numbers and revenues are down like 30 and 20% in both arts and hospitality. So those are the two industries which have been devastated by this. And we're starting to see this trend in mortgage pressure in houses and real wages starting to come down, but savings starting to increase. So he was saying in this live stream that it's very hard right now to predict where things are going, but you can imagine if things are cut off in September, we're going to have a massive deflationary moment in the economy. So I guess from your perspective, what are you thinking about in the next 6, 12 and 18 months for what's potentially going to happen?
Like I say, no one can be sure. And I think that the temptation is for people to have hot takes because, that'll make for good, content and LinkedIn posts and things like that. So, look, I can't say what I'm thinking for the next 6 to 12 to 18 months is going to happen. I know what I'm observing in real time. I've made some bets on that, have turned out right so far. So my general thesis for the past sort of 4 weeks since my sort of tracking of the health data started to sort of show or started to point at the situation that we're in now, which is that I think is what I'm referring to as sort of an opportunity for optimism arbitrage, which is that people, and this is probably a massive contributing factor to this is the media, but people in Australia have a very pessimistic view about what's going to happen to the economy. They have a very pessimistic view about the future, and yet if you ask them, and this was in that McKinsey report, that they then self-report that they don't have as pessimistic view about their personal sort of situation. So the single biggest concern in the McKinsey study that people had about the impact of COVID-19 was Australia's economy. Mm-hmm. That is the single highest thing that gets rated as a concern.
Yeah.
And then way down the list, that's up around 60%. Way down the list, around 30%, you have people being concerned about their job and being concerned about, I think they phrase it as being able to make ends meet. So there is a huge gap between the level of concern about the Australian economy and the level of concern about people's personal situations. Now, I don't want to make the fatal mistake that so many people make, which is equating or trying to treat an economy like a household budget, because it's not. But that gap is so large that there is this sort of what I'm calling this optimism arbitrage opportunity, which is the future is probably we can be more optimistic about the future than we're acting. There is more downside priced into markets. There is more pessimism built into modelling, and that things will probably be more optimistic in the long term, or things will turn out more optimistically in the long term than what's currently, the easiest way to look at it is what's currently being priced into the market. But that flows through to what the impact on sort of so many things is going to be. And now the caveat to that is any recovery, when we're talking about sort of positive sort of impact versus what we're expecting, is that any positive sort of change is going to be so secular. It's no matter what, people in the tourism industry, people in the airlines are in for a really, really bad time.
Yeah. It's going to be industry specific.
Yeah, but people who work in banks aren't. And so you have entire industries, you have entire, swathes of the population distributed not quite randomly, which I think is a, you know, there's a danger of real inequality in this recovery as well. But what you have is you have, you know, lots of people who are not going to feel a major economic impact from this 12 months. They'll feel it will be a, you know, mild recession sort of impact. And then you'll have other people that will feel a huge impact. But those people who feel a minor impact are also going to be living with record low interest rates, with, you know, the RBA yesterday, I think, was talking about, you know, sub 2% inflation, and it will probably be quite low sort of inflationary environment. And so, you know, reasonably, those people will be spending. They will have also gone through, and I haven't actually looked at household savings or if there's been a household savings report in the past couple of months, but, you know, I would take a stab that if you look at people who still are doing their jobs, if you look at white-collar workers that are working at home, if you look at people who sort of haven't had a big hit on their income, I'd hazard a guess that savings rates are through the roof simply because we can't do stuff.
Yeah, I'd agree.
So, you know, I think the recovery is going to be, or not even the recovery, already I think there's a sort of arbitrage between what people are sort of expecting to happen and what is going to happen. And at the same time, I think the watch out there is that it's going to be secular. It's going to throw up massive opportunities for inequality that we probably should watch out for as well.
Yeah, and I'd agree. I'm thinking about my own circumstances. I remember when this started really kicking off in Australia, probably March, April is when Lauren and I tightened our budgets. So we're already saving high amounts, but now we're probably saving ridiculous amounts. I mean, most of our entertainment and I guess going out money is not really spent at all. Instead, that money has been spent on improving things within our lives. I know that there are people we know that work at, say, organizations like Target, in the marketing team, and they've seen like record sales, obviously because people are shopping online, right? So I think that goes to your point that it will definitely be felt in areas where we're just not able to go spend that money ordinarily. And I was looking at, obviously going back to Martin's live stream last night, I'd already believed, coming from sort of that Buffett and Howard Marks school of investing, of opportunism, I'd already taken some investments probably about a month or so ago when the market really dipped down. But it was reinforced when I saw that primary industries really haven't changed, like mining and agriculture, and some parts of manufacturing aren't really that down that much at all, which tells me that people are still buying things that they need to make stuff, whether that be construction or whatever it may be.
Yeah, well, and actually there were construction numbers out yesterday that showed that construction was down significantly, which I thought was interesting and maybe surprised me a bit. But one of my clients is Your Grocer, who's a grocery delivery startup. And, you know, the fact is everyone's eating the same amount of food. Mm. It's just that the way that they're accessing that food is different. And so, you know, Your Grocer works with sort of independent grocers, works with, you know, dairy companies, things like that. So you take, you know, some of these independent dairies, like Schultz or St. David or Baramba, and they have vans and trucks that they're not using anymore. So there is a decrease in jobs because they're not going around and dropping off milk to as many cafes and restaurants and stuff. They're still doing a lot of cafes, but all the restaurants and stuff are out. Yeah. But people are still drinking the same amount of milk.
Yeah.
It's just they're doing it in different ways.
Different channels.
Yeah. It's there's actually a sidebar here on an interesting theory, which I think is partially true, but doesn't 100% explain the toilet paper, the run on toilet paper, which was a stat that out of the US, that something like 60% of all toilet paper is used not in the home. So it's basically people in workplaces or public places. 60% of toilet paper is like consumed outside of the home. So suddenly if everyone's trapped in their home, of course there's going to be a run on toilet paper.
Yeah. But there's also saying to the toilet paper thing as well. Like because the way that toilet paper is consumed normally and the way that it's packaged normally, you can't actually get that many packs of toilet paper on shelves. That's why they take up an entire fucking aisle. So when there was the original run, you know, people are buying 24 packs, but you don't need 24 rolls of toilet paper. It would be better if it was evenly distributed amongst people to have six each. And you can actually see that now when you go to Coles and they've still got their restrictions, you know, one toilet paper, two milk, et cetera. You're having to buy toilet paper more regularly than you would have in the past because they only have Coulton six pack or three pack toilet rolls, which is why I think there was that psychological element to that run on toilet paper. Is just the way that it's packaged. It scares the shit out of people when all of a sudden someone's like, oh, I've got to stock up on toilet paper and now there's none. And so it just becomes a self-fulfulfilling prophecy. But I want to just...
I think I've mentioned this before to you, that this whole crisis is going to, it's going to be fodder for sort of economics white papers for decades to come.
Psychology. Because that was the biggest thing for me is understanding the run on toilet paper. I had to understand that and I feel like I've gotten to it in the last month. Because
I look forward to the paper about you know, the invisible hand and toilet, the invisible hand grabbing for the toilet paper, you know.
Because I was in Japan in October 2019 during their typhoon, and I could understand the different runs on food because I'd seen it firsthand over a 48-hour period. And so we prepared by buying some more tin food because we don't have any tin food in the house. But I could not wrap... We never thought, oh, okay, toilet paper, we better stock up on that. So anyway, but this McKinsey report, we'll have to link it in the show notes. It's really interesting to see things like... I don't know if the audience can even see that because of the glare. You can't see shit. But basically down in the corner is us with... Japan, which is getting a bit sketchier, just speaking to some friends in Japan at the moment, Singapore and South Korea. So you can sort of see the decisions that were made have helped us immensely, but also as a proportion of GDP, the support in the economy. I think we're third to the UK and Germany, which is quite amazing for a conservative government. Mm. It makes you start to question a lot of things around... welfare in this country. But it's just a very interesting report to read that I think people, particularly in my parents' generation, would get a lot out of just understanding where things are. Have you been speaking to anyone in Adland at all at the moment?
Yeah. I've been talking to a few people in media, a few people in creative. Look, I mean, even the people in those industries were well aware that they were, you know, they've been coasting along for about 5 years, sort of ripe for, I don't want to, you know, use the D word, but ripe for massive disruption. Like that industry just needed to be completely turned upside down, you know, all the way from, you know, ad tech to creative production was, you know, just a house of cards in many ways. So this is... this is starting to precipitate a lot of that change, I think. The impact on media in particular, you know, how does that flow on to ad tech is going to be sort of interesting. The structural elements of sort of the agency model and how marketing works and how that interrelates with media, that structural piece is made up of lots of pieces. And it's like this big jumbled scaffold that is not just big and jumbled, but it's also so old that it's quite rusted. So it's not being dismantled quickly, but it is one of the long-term things that I think it's not like we're in for, you know, a sharp 3 month or 6 month change in the models of advertising and media and agencies. It's probably more like a 2 year sort of restructuring of what that looks like.
What do you think is the biggest thing that has to change about agencies? Particularly around marketing and creative agencies. I'm just for my own
just inefficiencies. Just inefficiencies, and probably a little bit of the hubris, like some of the narratives that were coming out of agencies would, you know, the idea that what advertising and marketing and agencies was doing was so central to businesses and you know, so fundamentally important to what they were doing that, you know, they should be, you know, absolutely central to, you know, all C-suite decisions was just, you know, nonsense. Yeah. You know, even a CMO, like, you know, I often used to, when I was in agencies, we'd often talk about this idea that, you know, there have been studies of CMOs and how they spend their time and their energy, and, you know, that they basically spent 10% of their time and energy thinking and caring about the media planning and media investment, and yet they have a whole agency with a whole, you know, depending on the size, with teams of people thinking about something that the CMO only spends one day a fortnight thinking about. And so within that was this assumption that advertising and marketing was so much more important than it really is. And I'm not saying it's not important, but I think the narrative sort of got carried away. And the number two is just the inefficiency, which I don't think is a surprise to anybody. It's in most people's interests to build complexity into the models. Most of what the agency world does is highly commoditized. That which isn't highly commoditized is extremely hard to measure. So, look, efficiencies just need to be created. I've talked to a few people who've gone into new agency positions during this crisis, and, you know, it's encouraging to talk to them and hear them talking about some of their plans, which is to basically take advantage of that fact, and that there's going to be the next sort of 12 to 24 months is going to see sort of CMOs on one end and media companies on the other end completely rethinking the structures that are built between them.
And when you say structures, does that mean the way that things are priced, the way that things are offered? Because it's got me thinking around the fact that a lot of agencies will go in and they'll either price to fit, or the fact that operationally they have X amount of staff and so therefore they have to charge Y amount no matter who the client is. Is that what you're thinking about?
Yeah, look, the products they're selling, the way they're selling them, the way they're pricing them, the way they're delivering them, the value that they bring, the way they're measuring them, the way that agencies are built, the way that they're structured, the way the holding companies operate. I think everything's up for change. You know, so much of it is, there's so many layers of complexity that have been built in because no one really wants to sort of look under the hood, that, you know, it's going to be a sort of a complicated unwinding. But at the same time, you've got, you know, you look at marketers and there's a lot of CMOs that used to be sort of somewhere in that structure, and they know how to sort of start to untangle it. So we'll start to see some good CMOs make some big changes. And look, I'm not saying it's the end of the holding companies. I think you take, you know, some of the people leading the holding companies, you know, really understand this. You look at, you know, probably I'm closest to WPP. So, you know, I have full confidence that Mark Reed, who's now running WPP, knows that this is what's going to happen. And some of the moves he's been doing, I think, show that they understand that there's going to be this sort of, you know, changing of the structure and vast simplification.
Yeah, there's a lot there. It's funny you mentioned the point about hubris, because there was like an agency that launched maybe a few months ago that had been from one of the big four agencies. So it's obviously an MD or someone who'd gone and started on their own. And they talk about new ways of working and doing things and being driven by data. And the comment section on Mumbrella is just my favorite. Like, it's the funniest thing to read. Someone was like, oh, great. Okay. So an agency that's using this, and this sounds like you're really changing the business model. and yeah. I feel like that's what you're tapping into.
Well, that's the scary thing, isn't it? Like, the people that think that they're doing things differently are not. The people that are going, oh, we're going to be informed by data. And you know, it's like the classic thing about standards. You look for a standard, you see that there's six of them and they've all got a problem. So you realize that, well, what if we built this one that solves all the problems, and now you've got seven standards? You know, it's you take what's wrong with an agency, you try and solve it, and now you've just got another problem, because you put by default, because of the structure, because of everything that exists and your inability to overcome it with one sort of, you know, big change, you have to adapt to it. And so what you'll end up with is, you know, you can go out with the best intentions to build, you know, this beautiful agency, this beautiful approach to marketing and media and creative and whatever. But you have to operate in an environment whereby you're going to naturally end up adding complexity, working out how to, you know, clip the ticket on the way through, and you end up acting like everyone who you're trying to overthrow.
Mm. Well, what would you say to a young agency owner like myself as to, because there are a few that listen to this podcast, how can they start to build on some of these inefficiencies and offer a better operating model?
It has to come from clients. So, look, there's a temptation to say, well, just, you know, work out radical approaches and go and, you know, completely change the way you're operating and go out and put that in market and stuff. But I actually think finding three clients who want to completely rethink the way that the model works is the best way to do it. Start there. I had to be a proponent of trickle down economics, but this is probably a case where, you know, it's only going to come from the top, because the clients are the ones that are paying the bills.
That's interesting. Okay, I want to jump to other elements of the economy. There's a lot on China here. I remember when we were first discussing, you know, the potential implications globally in the geopolitical realm. That was quite interesting. But I think the biggest and most obvious one or point to cover is supply chains. I think it's sort of obvious, at least politically and culturally at the moment, how many people are realizing the West was underprepared when it came to its own supply chains. By offshoring a lot of that stuff, we've therefore made ourselves very weak at responding to shocks like this. And the biggest discussion, the biggest change I've seen is the mentality from either side of politics that something has to change in terms of the way that supply chains are managed, and particularly the relationship with countries like China. It's not specifically China, but I think the thing that I've heard from either politics is countries that are more authoritarian, I guess, and exporting your supply chain to areas like that. So, you know, as an example, someone spoke about Vietnam recently, but there have been questions raised about, well, is that just more of the same if it's moved to Vietnam? Are we just funneling money to essentially slave labor so a certain class of people can do well in that home country to then potentially have another shock down 10 years from now that is basically the same thing? So I think you mentioned a term, distributed globalism. So you're sort of looking at more elements created locally but not wholly locally. What are your thoughts around supply chains at the moment?
I mean, I have prefaced that with I'm not a supply chain expert. I can talk a fair bit about getting food from Victoria onto into the houses of people in Melbourne. But there's a few parts to this. One is, and I realise that apparently, you know, we're not allowed to talk about things being an overreaction, but I think it might be an overreaction to say that. Or to plan for a future shock where all the countries close their borders again. Like, that's such a rare thing. You know, I've got a client in London who's ex-military, and he's lived a life of scenario planning. And, you know, you talk to him and you talk to people who do this stuff for a living, and they're like, you know what, this was never in the scenario plan. Like, every country just locking down their borders and everyone staying at home. No one thought about that. Mm. So, you know, if it could be a massive waste of money to start building in the future, whether it's supply chain or whether it's whatever, sort of plans that presume that this will happen again. But yeah, the other piece there is the sort of, you know, great globalism sort of neoliberal experiment fail in that respect. And you know what, maybe it did, but everyone really loved the cheap prices. The distributed globalism sort of idea, I think, is already taking shape. I think, you know, you mentioned Vietnam, you know, basically so much of China's, you know, when people think about China being the world's factory, it's just fundamentally not true anymore. You know, it moved to Vietnam years ago. It moved to the Philippines years ago.
Africa.
It's starting to move to Africa, which is a whole other sidebar, which is fascinating, not just from a supply chain perspective, but from a resources perspective, and could be a sad but positive thing for the Australian economy. I'll park that one over there. But yeah, there already is this distributed globalism, but it still has issues on, I guess, that sort of ethical layer. It still has issues on shutting down of supply chains. You know, for if you look at what's happening now, you're still going to have the same problems. So I think it's a tough one. I think you know, one of the dangers is now people are going to try and start optimizing their businesses or creating resilience in their businesses to deal with the shock that's just happened. And the shock that's just happened might be such an outlier that it means that their businesses are not resilient to more likely future shocks.
Mm. I do wonder though if the trend becomes not so much the shifting of supply chains, but it gets branded as like vertical integration and making that closer to your original base, because maybe there's savings on logistics as opposed to, you know, the costs that may be saved from manufacturing outside of Australia.
Yeah, and you know, look, there's sort of obviously technological advances in a lot of manufacturing that would sort of lead to that. Having said that, you know, Australia hasn't, you know, actually built a car on a major production line for a while now. So I think there's a couple things that I think could be positive out of this. One is, well, there's one that's quite dangerous, which is sort of this nationalism around sort of the production of things and the idea, you know, it's very strong in the US, and it always has been quite strong in the US, that, you know, things should be made in America. So there is a danger in that, because it feeds into the tribalism that is sort of the backlash to globalization and sort of neoliberalism. But one thing that I find super interesting, and there's been a bit of writing about this and a bit of thinking about this, is that more diverse societies are more interesting societies. So the more variation we have in the things that we do within our cities and within our country, the more diversity of thought and the more diversity of culture and the more diversity of people we get. So, you know, if Australia is just a mining country and four banks, you know, it's really bad for culture. It's really bad for cities. And, you know, you can see the extreme version of this in, you know, cities in China where, you know, everyone comes in, lives in the dormitory, you know, that they make, you know, there's cities that just make light bulbs, basically. And, you know, that's not good for culture. So I think an interesting sort of side effect that I really like the idea of is that actually by increasing diversification of what we're doing locally has some really nice sort of flow on effects of what's possible.
Right. It's sort of like the meme that has happened in agriculture in the last 10 years of going from feedlot farming to it's not animal husbandry, but it's sort of like distributed farming. So let's say you've got a 10-acre farm, you have cows that roam an acre or two, and then coming through next will be trailers of chickens that will scratch through the grass.
Yeah.
And then the next thing that will come through are pigs, and the next thing that come through will be goats. And so it'll be this, and I have a friend who has a farm like that, and the benefit is that your key commodity becomes something entirely different, which is feed or grass in this case. And so what actually happens in his farm is you capture more carbon and therefore you grow more grass, which means you save money on feed and you have a healthier, happier animal that goes at a higher price.
Yeah. So, and not only that, you also, you know, that sort of biodynamic approach is, builds in resilience.
Yeah.
Which can take outside of a farm situation. You can turn into a manufacturing and a services situation at a city scale or at a state scale or at a country scale. And it leads to sort of diversification, and that leads to resilience.
Yeah.
From an Australian point of view, I think that's, you know, one of the things that makes our economy relatively strong. We have sort of mining as a big thing, but outside of that, you know, the relatively good diversification is a strength in the economy as well. And like, you know, education right now is taking a massive hit, tourism is taking a massive hit, but there are other things that are not taking a massive hit. And so we're not as exposed as we could be.
Yeah. And these sort of things as well allow for a lot of arbitrage. Like the thing that's come from that agricultural development is that land that is highly eroded is basically worthless to most farmers who operate in the old way. But someone like my friend can come in and buy that land 50 cents, 40 cents on the dollar and improve that land over a 3-year period by this new approach and therefore increase the value of the land. So it's I think you're definitely right, and one of these things around supply chains and let's call it diversification is one of the topics we spoke about over email is the tech world and the tech capital. I think you were saying that this is going to be very interesting for Silicon Valley. How do you feel about that now since we last spoke about it around a month ago?
Probably more sure that it's I mean, there's Silicon Valley and there's sort of the tech world, and the two are sort of very, very tightly intertwined. I think, you know, the tech companies spent decades, you know, telling the world that they could solve any problem, and that software was eating the world. And, you know, that they were going to, you know, bring the internet to India or bring, you know, internet balloons to the world. And then, you know, basically saying we can solve all the world's problems from, you know, Mountain View and Menlo Park. And then the world had a really big problem and they have not been able to do a thing. They, you know, it's been remarkable how completely weak any response has been. You know, and there's the exception maybe being Google and Apple, which has been positive, but still, you know, I think they're releasing it sort of mid-May. Could they have done something faster? Definitely. You know, I had a long conversation with a technologist about how, you know, we would spec out a contact tracing app that utilized what's already in smartphones. Importantly, you know, something that I'm yet to see from Google or Apple is, importantly, smartphones that are 3 or 4 generations old, because currently everything I've seen is basically creating contract tracing for the rich, but it's not going to be very good for people in Brazil. It's not going to be very good for people in India. I think, like I said, after telling the world that, you know, technology is the solution to every problem, a big problem came along and, you know, they haven't been able to do a thing.
So what's the solution to every problem? who's the next elite that comes out and says that?
In what sense?
I don't know. I feel like what you're vocalizing is and has accelerated what people already thought about tech companies, that actually they're just big corporations now.
And I mean, this is the thing. What has this last 3 months done? It's just been a short circuit for what was going to happen over the next sort of 3 to 5 years anyway. And I think, you know, everyone who sort of spent enough time thinking about the tech world was well aware that the current Silicon Valley model, the current breed within there, if you think about, you know, Carlota Perez's sort of phases, that you know, it's that we're deep into the maturity phase of that part of Silicon Valley, that we have definitely gone through the frenzy, we've definitely gone through the synergy phase. All the money was made in frenzy and synergy. And you know, the venture capitalists, I think, probably know this deep down. And it's why they will, you know, they'll now let in, you know, PE firms into Series A's, because they know that now, you know, that it's not the same game. The sort of the ballpark they're playing in is that maturity phase, and what they're looking for, and you know what VCs in particular have been, you know, furiously looking for the past 3 or 4 years is what's the next eruption phase? What's the new thing? And you know, there hasn't been anything near enough to being big enough. That it's been meaningful. You know, for a while it was blockchain, and then it was sort of AI and ML. You know, for about 6 weeks it was CRISPR. You know, they're furiously looking for this next eruption phase. But the fact is that tech in general, as we sort of look at it now, is in that maturity phase, and these companies are just big companies now. Silicon Valley is you know, essentially just the new Wall Street. So if it's the people who have power, people who have money. Power and money generally makes you a douchebag. So increasingly seeing douchebags.
I still think, though, that this meme of distribution, and particularly things like blockchain, have a part to play.
I think they will, but I think they're not fundamental to that eruption phase.
Right, okay. What do you think is most likely to be fundamental to that, or you can't see anything yet?
You can't. I mean, yeah, you just can't see. You can't see until you're in it. And, you know, if you consider that really the last, you know, the last sort of cycle in that sort of Carlota Perez model was probably smartphones. And, you know, everyone has, well, not everyone, but there are multiple theories about, you know, what do we actually call that phase? But I think the internet was one where we went through the eruption, frenzy, synergy, and maturity phase. I think smartphones was another. And now we've gone through that, and all the things that come with smartphones, and you know, whether it's just the fact that we're creating GPS camera chips at such a scale that it allows other things, but when the smartphone came along, we didn't know that that was going to have the impact that it did. So you know, if there is a contender, ironically, it's probably I don't want to say 5G, but it's probably this idea that just everything is on the network.
Yeah, that is interesting to me, and it's funny to see the just, you know, what's really funny is this whole thing about people who are paranoid that 5G spreads coronavirus, but they're willing to use 4G. It's got to be one of the greatest ironies out there. yeah, I think you're right. I think it's been interesting using the NBN and that sort of whole crossover period. And I noticed that when we were going through that, the ADSL that we had connected to our location was so useless that we just went straight to wireless. And the 4G was good enough. The only problem is they throttled it. So I can see with a 5G environment how it's just cheaper to move to having some sort of, you know, wireless connection as opposed to getting cable and paying for all that fiber cable. I mean, that is one of the big things in India, right, is they skipped cable altogether and went straight to wireless, and they have pretty good internet for a country that's got 1.4 billion people. I want to touch on China. I know you were thinking about a month ago that it seemed likely about a month ago, the way that things are rolling out, that the US was in a really critical area, and that they did not look good globally. They're pulling money from the WHO. Trump was in denial about what was going on, essentially. People were, or seemed to be, in denial in the US that it really existed, and, you know, we're seeing cases now where they actually think it was in the US from as far back as December. I think there was a case of pneumonia revised in California from December. But that was one of the other big things that I've noticed is the change in mentality from either side of politics around China, particularly here. Here was the biggest shock for me when Penny Wong came out and spoke about we need to have this this investigation into what happened. That was when I started to really take notice and say, like, okay, China politically outside of their domestic market is in big trouble, like big, big long-term trouble. And so everyone's spoken about Thucydides' trap, which is, you know, you've got a rising empire and you've got your current empire, and there's this sort of clashing, and that the rise of China is sort of like a another law of Newtonian physics, as I wrote in our notes. But I just don't see that panning out as people thought it would maybe 2 months ago. So I guess I'm curious as to your perspective. How do you see all of this panning out? Is there going to be an investigation?
Well, there's a lot in there. I think, you know, the idea that war is inevitable, I think, is probably this is the exception that proves the rule. I don't think there'll be, you know, large degrees of physical confrontation as China continues its rise. And I think its rise is inevitable. I think that on the other side, I can completely invert that and say there already is a war, and it's happening online. There is a lot of cyber sort of war going on. Essentially, it's weird to say that it's an unregulated war, but essentially, the internet is an unregulated sort of battleground. So there's a lot going on there than I think we think. I think, you know, even I'd be surprised, I think, if I actually understood the scale, and I don't think anybody truly understands the scale of what's going on online. I think that America, the US's handling of this is one of the greatest own goals in, you know, geopolitics, probably in history. It's, you know, it's basically, you know, created or completely diminished a lot of any confidence that the sort of global community had in the US's ability to lead. And particularly not just to lead domestically, but to actually lead in the world. Like, you know, really, you know, since post-war, that has been the US's role, and the role that they sort of carved out for themselves as a global superpower was not just to lead domestically, but to lead domestically by example, and where necessary, to be the global leader and to actually go beyond their borders. And I think the complete incompetence that they've shown with the coronavirus has massively diminished that. I basically just don't trust most of what I hear these days. So when I sort of hear or when I see a lot of blame being piled on China and sort of this idea about we need an investigation, I think that probably there's a lot of motivations behind that. You know, I think the motivation from politicians, you know, domestic politicians, so sort of, you know, Penny Wong is probably she's just getting a lot of questions, and she's, you know, people respond to what they're seeing in the media. The media is basically looking for any angle on this they can. They see that, you know, whipping up tribalism is a fantastic way to get eyeballs right now. So, you know, in a world where over the last 3 months everyone has become, you know, more tribal. I noticed even before when you were sort of holding up that chart that had Australia on it, you actually said us, you know, you said, you know, we're here and Japan's here and South Korea's here. Just, you know, tribalism is baked into this crisis. And so I think there is, there's a sort of a natural tone of tribalism that's been everywhere. And it's unsurprising to see that then bubble up and have politicians responding by saying, oh, we need an investigation. Mm-hmm. When I'm not sure what an investigation would prove. And look, to be honest, I think that that sort of posturing to a large degree probably is only going to strengthen China's position in the long term, because, you know, this isn't weapons of mass destruction. You know, no one can go in and, you know, properly investigate and understand things. The fact that there is censorship going on in China is the most, you know, unsurprising thing on the planet. So why there needs to be sort of investigation, I'm a bit baffled on. And I feel like China basically has the strength at the moment that they can stand there and have this sort of, you know, fire coming in from people saying, oh, we need investigation. Oh, you've covered things up. And they're just like, yeah, but, you know, look at the US. And that's just a bin fire over there. So I don't think it will do a lot of damage to them. And look, I mean, you know, the history of China is that they are more patient than anybody else. They've been waiting 100 years. You know, if this takes them another, you know, if this march takes them another 20 years, pardon the use of the word march there, but if this phase takes another 20 years, they don't care. You know, they've had their sort of century of embarrassment. If it goes another 20 years, you know, in a 5,000, you know, what they consider to be a 5,000 year history, they're fine with that.
Yeah. I don't think it's as inevitable. I think there are massive issues that China has, both economically and politically, that means that it just will never get to where the US has been in the past. Like,
but the US can come down to them.
But if you had asked me back in 2011, maybe 2010, I would have said, oh yeah, for sure. Because I think what really changed in China was the way that the country was run. Like, China, in particularly Shenzhen, I remember my dad told me this because he would go to Shenzhen for work maybe once every couple of years. And he said, it was the change in the mood and the excitement from locals that made him start to realize, you know, people were very excited, very passionate. It was almost an inevitability. You could just see it in Shenzhen. Like, this will be the next Silicon Valley, if it isn't already. And this will be where we all come to as sort of the center of the tech world and the developing economics of the world. But then a few years later, he was like, okay, things are starting to change. The mood of the people is changing, particularly the younger generation. The way that people do business is changing. He said to me, it's become a bit more gangster-like, if that makes sense. There's a lot more under the table type stuff. It had become less transparent. So I think that is a massive issue. And also the fact that they still rely on this economy, which requires US dollars. Until they can get around that fact, I just can't see them being the next. I can see them being the regional superpower, but I can't see them being equal to the US for how shit the US has been.
Well, and that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it's fascinating to be saying this now, because you certainly wouldn't, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, which is that the most unpredictable part of the equation is actually what's happening, what's going on in the US. That's the biggest unknown factor.
Yeah.
But I think another angle on that, though, is that, and you know, this is the thing, if you want to think about this on the sort of time scale of like, you know, K waves of like 60 years, then I think a danger is, and it's been a bit of a theme of this whole chat, is that it's hard to see what you're in the middle of. And it's hard to sort of recognize the change, because the change fundamentally is unfamiliar. And so I think if we're looking for, you know, the whatever the next global superpower is, to look like what the previous one was, that's the danger. So do you have to, you know, control the currency? I'm not sure. Is the sort of level of censorship actually an issue, or actually is it perfectly fine? If you can sort of fast forward a little bit, and if you do a bit of mental gymnastics and say, right, let's consider, like, in 20 years, China is sort of a global superpower, what could that look like? I think maybe something interesting to consider is in 20 years, so when I'm 60, the difference between sort of, let's call it sort of that, the post-war K wave, where America really dominated, the difference between that and a China sort of world-centered world is probably less different to sort of Victorian England, so the British Empire, the peak of the British Empire, and sort of Hitler and Stalin, and sort of that. And yet that sort of, if you just break things into 60-year periods, that's basically what you have. You know, if we had China's rise now, you take that into sort of one K wave, and then you go right post-war America and them dominating. So before that, you know, before that you have sort of the rise of nationalism and fascism. And before that, you know, the 60 years before that is essentially Victorian England and sort of the peak of the British Empire.
Mm.
You know, the difference between the British Empire and sort of, you know, World War One Europe was remarkable. The difference between sort of a, you know, US-centric post-war, you know, towards the end of that era, sort of neoliberal, sort of organized world, and where we could end up with China, is probably not that different. Partially because China's just not interested in empire building.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know about the empire building thing. I feel like they've got some plans in the South China Sea, but there
there is one massive caveat. There is, they're not interested in empire building, apart from where they have always been interested in empire building.
Yeah.
And you know, but the great thing about China is you can just look back over 5,000 years and you will know how they're going to act for the next 5,000, essentially. Mm. Where they're not going to embark on empire building outside of the pieces that they've always felt a part of, you know, the center of the world. That, you know, do we return to a tributary state sort of system? Like, you know, has the, you know, we were talking about Vietnam before, you know, has the tributary system actually ever disappeared? It definitely sort of declined, well, you know, in the era of the Asian tigers, but arguably, you know, the tributary system is on its way back. And to, you know, one way to look at the whole Belt and Road plan is that it is a massive revival of the Chinese tributary state system. So, you know, it's not terribly hard to see what they're planning to do, and it's one of the things I find fascinating about China is it's pretty much out in the open. They're pretty open about what they want. They're just more patient than everybody else.
Mm. The point about superpowers is interesting. I feel like the commonality amongst all those is that they've always been the maritime superpower. That's at least the analysis at the geopolitical level. So that is one thing that China will have to work on over the next 20 years is their navy. They if they want to be anywhere near being a superpower, they need to have at least 10 carriers, I would say, particularly in Asia.
So here's an argument though, because actually if you wind back enough, the whole seagoing, you know, dynasty starts to be questioned. You do have periods where, you know, being on the ocean was the thing, but you also have periods where you had a ruling, you know, the global superpower was not necessarily seafaring. But one challenge that I'd have to that is that perhaps the new seafaring nation is actually the one with the strongest navy on the internet.
Mm, that's interesting. The strongest navy on the internet. I like that.
So in that case, as far as I would be concerned, China's won.
Mm. Yeah, there's so much there because I don't even know how those sort of things are measured. And I actually put a note down from our earlier points around the internet, trying to understand how those things are measured. We're running out of time. I could ask you a million more things like, you know, I don't know if you're going to be getting it, but the cash flow boost. I feel like so many businesses are getting this cash flow boost, and I'm intrigued as to what people are doing to invest it in. Personal liberties. There's a bunch of stuff here, but we do have to jump into some rapid fire questions. So now that you've moved, I've got to ask, what does the morning and evening routine look like?
Look, I've got clients in the US, UK, Dublin, so I'm always on calls early. So in that sense, it hasn't changed. I moved out of my office when we moved here because I've got my own office here. That wasn't actually because of coronavirus; it was just because I had an office here. So yeah, that part hasn't changed much. I'm not actually going out physically and seeing my Melbourne clients, which is disappointing and annoying, and I miss them, but you know, lots of screen time. Not a big change to the way that I work and how I work. If anything, it's become a little less structured. because previously, if I was physically with somebody, then obviously I was 100% focused on them. But now, you know, it's the task switching is probably maybe 20% higher than it used to be. And to be honest, I'm looking forward to going back to a world where I can be more clear on how I'm looking at my time.
Yeah, I could see how that physical element would add to that. I think you mentioned it earlier, but the biggest thing I'm missing is interpersonal or human contact. I never thought I'd miss the office so much because I thought they're just a distraction factory. But it's getting very fucking frustrating. Like I like the ability to be able to do deep work in the morning and then go in the afternoon and have conversations around things.
Yeah.
At night, what are you sort of watching in the evenings?
Sadly, I've been doing a lot of work with Dublin in the evenings recently. And when I haven't been doing that, we've basically been sort of doing the house. So I've been running around fixing little things or cleaning up after tradespeople. So sadly, not a lot of relaxation. The only thing that the sort of the one treat that we've had is we watched the second season of Afterlife on Netflix.
Okay, very good series.
It's just wonderful. It's just so lovely. I love it.
It's
everything I want. It's not too, you know, it's not a brain drain. It looks, you know, it's just a beautiful thing. I love Ricky Gervais sort of trying to be genuine.
I can't believe I've gotten my dad into Ricky Gervais. I think he saw his special and then he was like, oh, he's got this show, Afterlife. And then he goes and watches both seasons within like a week. I'm nearly at the end of this season because I've been intermittently watching the Michael Jordan doco, which I found very fascinating as a sports fan. What do you think's been the best purchase of something? It's going to be under $200 that you've been using throughout this time. It doesn't have to be made during this lockdown period, but what's sort of been the handiest item that you've come across?
Under $200, by far, my Stanley Fatmax ratcheting screwdriver. It's ratcheting, so you can really easily like do things, undo things. It's got all the bits in the end, so you can very easily swap out bits, and you can do hex bolts. You can do anything you want. It's a really solid tool. One of my mantras that I stole from my dad was never buy cheap tools, and it's a beautiful tool. And I actually commented to our electrician the other day, who handily our electrician is my best mate. So it was a bit of a hack. I commented to him, I've never loved this tool so much because I'm literally just running around the house and there's so many things I'm saying, I've got to whip that off and clean it up or fix it up or change it or move it. So yeah, Stanley Fatmax screwdriver.
Stanley
Fatmax. Check the show links. Is that what we said? You can get an Amazon affiliate thing.
Stanley Fatmax. Is that one of those things, like, did you get it from Bunnings? Have you made many Bunnings trips at all during this?
So many Bunnings trips.
Yeah. The thing is, I stopped making Bunnings trips about 2 weeks ago when I got scared as to how many people were arriving at Bunnings. But it has been amazing. Like, because I'm really into bonsai now. Like, I started probably in November, but I am deep, deep in it now. Like, I'm talking looking at videos and forums on the perfect soil mix. to get growth out of certain plants. So little visits to Bunnings has been handy. Side note for anyone listening, never buy a bonsai from Bunnings. They're absolute dog shit. Go find
it's like a place in Hawthorne, isn't it? There's a place in Hawthorne that's
bonsai
like
farm.
That
guy is amazing. He actually had the first ever bonsai show in Australia on SBS and I didn't notice at all, but
just amazing bonsai there.
Yeah,
expensive bonsai there.
Expensive, but also like for supplies, he's very affordable. Like most pots are around $20-$40. Like we're talking very, very good pots, and his soil mix is elite. And if you bring anything into him, he'll tell you what to do with it. So, can't remember his name, but I love him. And he's unfortunately only open one day a week and currently closed due to lockdown. So I'm looking forward to going next Saturday. Look, Nick, as always, love doing this. Sad that we can't catch up for coffee at the moment. But hopefully once some of these lockdowns are relaxed a bit more, we can do that again. But thanks for coming on the show.
All right. Thank you. Who knows? Maybe Monday we'll be able to have a coffee.
Hey! It is Monday, isn't it? May 11th.
May 11th.
Okay, there you go. All right, thanks, mate.
Wonderful. Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening in to this episode. If you like it, do leave us a written review on your podcast app, as it helps us continue going on a weekly basis, and we do love reading those reviews as well. If you want the show notes, you can find that below, or with our previous guest at neural.com/podcast. That's neural.com/podcast. To watch the full video, search Uncommon Show on YouTube, and to keep up to date with behind the scenes and clips for the show, you can find us at uncommon_show on Instagram. But until next time, guys, thank you so much for listening.